True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
There was a body on the floor. There was 9 empty cartridges. And the smell of a butcher shop.
Tracy's story was that this was a home invasion, that she was threatened and she killed him in self-defense.
That was her story, yes. She had constructed a story that her first husband had hired a hitman to kill her, or hitmen to kill her. And in order to support that allegation, she needed a body. It's absolute cold-blooded. It's horrific.
She hated her first husband so much that she executed somebody to make it look like he did it. Dustin Wheaty was the perfect person for this. You know, he's not the most popular kid in class, didn't have a lot of friends, but she couldn't have gotten anybody else to do that or go along with it, you know. I mean, she's a liar. She only cares about herself. You know, there's not one thing that comes out of her mouth that isn't either A, just a flat out lie, or B, a statement made for the purposes of getting something.
Finding out the true reason of why Tracy took my son's life to this day haunts me, because in her process of trying to save her own son from her husband, she chose to take my son away. And that's just so hard. A very evil, evil person. You know, and in my opinion, she killed my husband too. You know, it's not, he didn't just go out to our son's gravesite and put a bullet in his heart because he had no pain. You know, she did that to him. She drove him to that.
On the 5th of March, 2004, Tracy takes out a life insurance policy on you for $1 million. Did you know about that?
Only when it arrived in the mail.
Why would she want that policy?
She attempted to murder me. She had drugged me, and I went to sleep on the bed, and she had rolled me up in a king-size cotton sheets. And when I woke up, I was in a cocoon state, and she was sitting on top of me, and I had a plastic bag over my head.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Tracy Richter's outrageous, crime-filled life could be the basis for a horror film featuring an attractive, revenge-oriented narcissist willing to do whatever it takes to get what she wants and hurt anyone who gets in her way. The only problem is no one would believe it, and that may explain why she got away with it for as long as she did. Tracy lied to, cheated on, stole from, and physically attacked her first husband. When they finally divorced, she falsely accused him of child sexual abuse, enlisting her own son to tell horrible lies about his own father. Although she would remarry, thus finding a new man to deceive, her grudge against her first husband would never leave her. Tracy made elaborate, cold-blooded plans and went through with them, killing an innocent young neighbor to set up her ex and retain custody of her son. As we talk about the life and crimes of Tracy Richter, a.k.a. Tracy Pittman, a.k.a. Tracy Roberts, a.k.a. Sophie Edwards, and on, we will examine how she managed to hurt so many people for so long before she was finally brought to justice.
Okay, so I've been looking forward to having a case that took place in Iowa because I've been wanting to review this beer for I don't know how long.
So it's a good beer.
Yeah, this is like the number one beer. It's
good.
Highly acclaimed.
All
so
right.
The beer... And I know everyone's going to get tired of this, but it's a stout. It's Kentucky Brunch brand stout brewed by Toppling Goliath Brewing Company in Decorah, Iowa. And did I mention this is a world-class beer?
You did not.
So it's a black beer, little tan head. The aroma and taste are just absolutely out of this world. Some whiskey, cocoa, coffee, maple syrup, tiny bit of cinnamon. They all work so well together. It's a very smooth, easy-drinking beer. It is 12%. alcohol by volume, so be careful, kiddies. But it is just an outstanding, wonderful, wonderful beer.
Well, thank you for bringing it today. I'm excited to try it.
Let's open it up and head on down. Our fellow drinkers are waiting.
All right, we're all settled in here. Got my beer. Why don't you start the story?
Yeah, the quiet end is rather quiet tonight.
It's how it should be.
Yeah, I guess. We had all the excitement with Wayne Newton, or whoever purported to be Wayne Newton.
Right, right.
I mean, that was pretty cool.
It was.
But now we're back to the usual.
We are, and the dartboard is not a big hit. Nobody's playing, so it actually works out well for us.
Well, I always wondered how you can drink beer or other spirits and throw darts.
I don't know. They do it all the time in England, right?
And not hit a bystander or something.
Well, you have to stay away from the board, obviously.
I guess so. All right, let's start. John Pittman, who was a fourth-year medical student, was working a rotation at the hospital one night when he met a woman who claimed to be a radiographer. She was gorgeous. She had flawless skin, plump lips, high cheekbones. She had a warm and welcoming smile, long, rich brown hair, which was teased up into a 1980s style. She had hospital scrubs cinched at her tiny waist, and she smelled great, too. Wow, he's smitten. So Tracy was 20 years old. John Pittman was 10 years older than her. Now, at first he was attracted to her, but then Tracy opened her mouth and talked. She could be difficult and irritable. She lost her temper with John after he tried to talk to her about something that had happened at work. But then the next day, Tracy apologized. She might have been abrasive and unsophisticated, but she seemed genuine, and John liked her. It impressed him that such a young woman was so assertive and sure of herself, so he asked her out, and they went on a double date with friends. According to John, they slept together that first night that they went out. Tracy, however, later claimed she went home early that night, and sex would have been out of the question since she lived at home with her parents. And they went out a few more times and were getting along rather well. But just after the third date, Tracy left John a note reading, "I think I love you." It seemed fast to him. Seems fast to me.
Yeah, but if she's feeling it, sometimes that happens.
I think I'm watching an episode of The Bachelor or something, you know?
It can happen, sure.
I'd be suspicious, I would think.
Well, she's not saying I'm madly in love with you. She's saying I think I love you. It could be sweet. It just depends what you think of the person who's leaving it for you.
Okay.
Right? If it's mutual, you like it.
Yeah.
And Tracy was very adaptable, of course, because once she found out there was something about her personality that John didn't like, she just changed that behavior. So John moved to New York in late 1986 and went on to Virginia for medical training. Tracy wrote him love letters while he was gone. And John later called the letters mushy. But he was falling for her, too, because he kept in contact with her. And he also asked her to come to Virginia. And she said she didn't want to at first, but then she gave in and she did move. So John and a friend drove out to Chicago to pick Tracy up. And she'd been telling him all along that her parents didn't want her to move. But she was willing to go against their wishes, she said, because she was in love with him. But when they arrived, Tracy had all her stuff packed and ready to go. And out of earshot of Tracy, John spoke to her mother, who told him that she supported the move completely. John's parents lived in a condo in Vail, a well-known skiing spot. And in 1987, John invited his roommates and their girlfriends there. The first few days went pretty well. Everyone was relaxed and having a good time. But soon Tracy was crying and complaining. She was complaining about some of John's friends and girlfriends. Because she wasn't a good skier, she said she felt left out. She lashed out at everyone for not including her and taking off on a section of the mountain that they all knew she couldn't attempt. So she talked like it was a plot against her. She screamed right into one of his roommates' faces. And she was so enraged that she charged at this guy, hitting him in the face, and sent his glasses flying across the room. So John intervened and grabbed her, and one of the girls in the group demanded that they all leave immediately. She said she couldn't stand another night under the same roof as Tracy. So when they returned home, Tracy worked to place a wedge between John and his friends, and also his parents, and she would make him choose between them and her. Now, you think all these things would tip him off that maybe this isn't the woman to marry.
Wouldn't you? I mean, my God, this woman. Here they are on a ski vacation with some friends. They seem to be having a good time. And then she goes completely ballistic.
Right, which seems to be the way she was.
And not just verbally. I mean, slapping him, knocking his glasses off and stuff.
That's pretty out there, yeah.
I'd be saying, see you later, girl.
Right.
I'm done. But not our boy John.
No.
He was in love.
Well, that's the problem.
So he was scheduled, John was scheduled, to begin a residency in Denver. Tracy was difficult to deal with, obviously. She was very needy, very dramatic. But inexplicably, he wanted her to move with him. Tracy had always wanted dogs, she said, just as John did, and they both wanted a home. John proposed to Tracy, and she accepted. So he was living in Denver with Tracy. They were engaged, starting to plan their wedding. They bought a house, got a dog, so everything's lovely. But Tracy soon approached John and said that she was lonely. Tracy didn't want anything to do with being a part of his group of friends, who was mostly other residents and their wives. Well, sure, who do you hang out with?
Yeah, because he's always working.
Right. This was at the time when you were expected to put in incredibly long, ridiculous hours.
Yeah, and she started complaining that John was a burden at home because he made messes and didn't clean up after himself. And also he was on call at the hospital every other night and gone over 100 hours a week.
Yeah, those surgical residents, they're nuts.
So they had fights about pets when Tracy wound up taking in 3 dogs and 2 cats. She seemed to be having a hard time keeping up with the housework, and according to Tracy, sex had become boring and infrequent. So she claimed that she was a virgin when she met John, even though many would come forward to dispute that later. So it was hard to believe, because she was very sexually active, I guess, throughout her life. One law enforcement source claimed that Tracy later went out to meet married men online, where she'd take them to a hotel, sleep with them, and then wait until they fell asleep to extort them. What she would do was position herself on the bed with her breasts exposed and with a guy asleep next to her. Then she'd take a picture. She'd meet the guy again, have sex with him, and leave an envelope on the nightstand with a photo and the note inside. If you don't want your wife to see the photo, send me $2,500. And they almost always did send her the money. Now see, she had to meet them twice because this was before selfies on the cell phone. Nowadays, right. She could have done it all in one swoop.
Yeah, could have been much more convenient
for her. More efficient, yes. Yeah.
Now in August 1988, John and Tracy were married. They had a honeymoon in Hawaii, and then Tracy went back to the same complaints. Not enough attention, the dogs were more important to her husband than she was, John spent too much time working on the house when he was home, and he spent too much time out of the house on call. As the months went by, John realized Tracy wasn't adjusting to being married to a surgical resident. And although he really wanted to be a general surgeon, he decided that becoming a plastic surgeon would allow him to spend more time at home, because the hours would be more manageable.
Mm-hmm.
On the downside, that's another 2 to 3 years of training.
Right.
So.
But they make a lot of money.
But yeah, if you're a good plastics guy, you're rolling in the dough.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess he's thinking in the long run, he will have more time to be with his wife.
Yeah, there's not as much on call with that.
And he's going to be making a shitload of money.
Yes.
Which is probably going to be good for her, too.
You would think, but it really didn't work out. During the summer of 89, as John was ending his second year of residency, they decided to visit his parents in South Carolina. So this trip was a chance for them to reconcile and kind of start again, hopefully rekindling their romance. But a short time after the visit, Tracy was in tears. She was pregnant. And she was really unhappy about that. John, on the other hand, was excited about it. And eventually Tracy accepted the pregnancy, and she started to seem excited too, planning for the baby. So she started thinking maybe this is what they both needed, a family. And in July of 1989, John was entering his third year of surgical residency, and Tracy was completely exhausted. She was stressed and angry that John was leaving her home alone, and unfortunately, the relationship deteriorated even more instead of getting better. Which we know, pregnancy seldom helps a relationship.
That's for sure. Now, near her 7th month of pregnancy, in December of 1989, John's parents contacted him about a problem. Someone had gotten a hold of their credit card and charged numerous items, which had been delivered to the Vail condo before being stolen in one swift move of arriving in one truck, then leaving in another. So Tracy stepped in and called the Vail Police Department after John explained the situation. Now, it might have seemed odd that Tracy wanted to be so involved, because it was her behavior that made John's parents suspicious. During the inquiry into the crime in February 1990, Tracy gave birth to Bert, the son, and police in Vail were narrowing the suspects for the furniture theft down to two people, and they were a local decorator and our girl Tracy. Tracy claimed complete innocence and seemed offended that anyone could even suggest she was involved.
Well, of course she did. That's how she did this stuff. I mean, she was kind of clever, this whole idea of having the stuff delivered and then having another truck right there to pick it up. It's ballsy.
It is.
John's parents came to Vail that April to visit, and John and Tracy had purchased their own condo there. So John offered his parents the chance to check out their new place while they were in Vail, and they noticed that there were things in John and Tracy's condo that looked like the things that had been bought with the credit card that had been stolen. So one report later had the amount of this theft at about $15,000, and John's parents were shocked and outraged that Tracy did this. She'd stolen their card, charged all these items, and had the nerve to furnish her new condo with these things.
I think that's pretty brazen.
Very brazen.
Isn't it? Wow.
And they called John and told him about it, and they hired a private investigator. So this caused problems between John and his parents.
Huh. Yes.
And after an investigation, the PI also narrowed the case down to two suspects, the decorator and Tracy. Now, maybe that was what Tracy had wanted, was to cause a wedge between John and his parents. That might have been part of the reason why she did it, because she really hated them. And she didn't want him to associate with his family at all. It was never proven that she was involved, and they never had her charged for credit card fraud. But they do believe that she did that. Having this new baby took a lot of patience that Tracy really didn't have. She wanted to breastfeed Bert, but she wasn't producing enough milk. So, a story goes, as John told it, that one night when he was in bed sleeping, he heard yelling so loud that it woke him up. And as he got out of bed, the yelling grew louder. He was tired, he'd been working close to 120 hours per week by then, and he heard Tracy screaming, "Suck! Suck! Suck!" When he got into the nursery, he saw that she was yelling at the baby. Her face was all red and she was enraged, and when he looked in, he saw that she was actually shaking Bert. So John said he rushed over and stopped her, but Tracy would deny that she ever did anything wrong. So that's kind of scary.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like child abuse.
Absolutely.
So John tried to move on and help Tracy with raising Bert. He wanted to make it work to provide a stable environment for his son. On December of 1990, John was put on active duty from his reserve unit because of the Gulf War. After going to San Antonio for a couple weeks of training, he was sent back home. Then when he returned, the marriage had a short period of harmony, but that didn't last. By 91, Tracy was acting crazier than ever. Her complaining about everything increased, and she was more intense and acting out more. She ranted, raved, screamed, yelled, and became violent. She accused John of saying things that he did not recall ever saying. She called him a rotten husband and claimed he neglected her. She'd hit him. He'd come through the door after a 20-hour shift and she'd go crazy, screaming and accusing him of cheating on her when he was actually working. She also struck him repeatedly on his body. She intimidated him. She tried to push him into striking back. That didn't work, so she started throwing household objects at him. And another concern of John's became the family finances. He's working more, making more than enough money to provide for the family, but it was never enough.
Well, no, she was a spender. In early 1991, Tracy spent thousands of dollars on breast implants. And in April 1992, she took off her top and showed off her breasts to her friends at Bert's daycare. Now, she'd been working at a medical facility and had begun an affair with a man who worked there. At home to John, this was a different story. She told him that she was being sexually harassed at work. She said this guy was someone closely connected to the owners of the company and that he was stalking her. Since she had said no to his advances, she said, the company had been complaining about her job performance. But Tracy had told her son's babysitter all about this love affair she had with the guy. And she even told her that she'd become pregnant with the guy's child and had had an abortion. So we've got two stories there. And Tracy also got involved with some shady characters that she met at strip clubs, both male and female strippers who were using drugs and were possibly engaged in other illegal activities. Tracy wasn't only having an affair with the guy she worked with, but with a male dancer and another guy all at the same time. Then she sold one of their dogs and told John that it had been run over by a car. She was resenting the dogs because she thought he liked them better than her. And he might have.
Yeah.
Well, she's tough.
She's not a very likable person.
No, and then there was this major incident that occurred when a gun was discharged into the ceiling of the Pittman's home. And Tracy said it was all John's fault.
She said she had accused him of infidelity, and he had produced the gun in a threatening manner. And after he left, the gun discharged as she went to unload it. Now, John told a completely different story. He said he was inside the garage attached to their condo, working on the family car that night. Afterwards, he went inside, took off his shoes because they were greasy. And when Tracy saw the shoes on the floor, she went wild. She picked them up, opened the garage door, and tossed the shoes into the garage. Then she went after John, yelling, "You are never going to leave this house alive. I'm going to kill you."
That's serious.
That is. So John took the wise path and decided not to argue and left the house. Now he's walking out the door, he hears a gunshot. He turns around, ran back into the condo. Tracy was talking to herself. She's on the couch, apparently calm.
Which is weird, because she'd just been in an outrage.
Right. She said she had tried to kill herself, but now she was fine. Now, there was a bullet hole in the ceiling. Tracy went into the bedroom. John called 911. When police and the EMTs arrived, they gave John the option of either allowing them to take Tracy away to be evaluated or not. A social worker arrived, and after evaluating Tracy, didn't want to admit her. And she can stay, John decided. Now, a police report of the incident backed up John's version. So Tracy did start therapy after this incident. She went out and found a new job. For a while, they didn't argue as much, and Tracy seemed to be much more relaxed.
Yeah, but this whole thing, I don't know why they didn't want to admit her. I mean, if the social worker tells him that she doesn't need to be, he doesn't have much choice but to keep her.
Yeah, I mean, to me it sounds like she needed to be admitted, right?
Right.
And I'm not sure. I mean, maybe he's just going by the social worker's evaluation who said, "I don't think she needs to be admitted." But,
well, yeah, because if the social worker says she doesn't need to, they might not do it.
Right.
So I don't know. But, you know, I guess she got the therapy. She was acting better. She went out, got a new job.
So it looked like things were improving.
For a short time. So then in March 1992, John had a back injury while sledding with Tracy and Bert. And this is when the marriage really fell apart. Tracy didn't even hide anymore what she was doing. She did whatever she wanted, went out whenever she wanted, slept with whoever she wanted, and spent whatever amount of money she wanted to. Each job Tracy took always turned into a big drama and ended up with her leaving or being fired. While working for one doctor, she took home patient claim forms, altered them, and had patient benefits sent to her home, where she cashed the checks. By early summer 1992, Tracy agreed to move to Chicago so John could begin a plastic surgery fellowship at Northwestern. John's credit card company called and said someone had stolen his card numbers and charged each account up to the maximum, but all the charges had occurred after they moved. So what they figured out is that it was probably Tracy's new friends. And also before leaving, Tracy had asked John to increase his life insurance. So that made him nervous.
Yeah, it's a little ominous.
Mm-hmm. So in preparation for their move to Chicago, Tracy volunteered to have their dogs and cats transported by plane. But then Tracy told John that the airline had made a mistake and their pets had been shipped overseas to a research lab. So of course John was devastated. But a week or so later, when he visited the old house, he found out that one of his cats was still hanging around the neighborhood. So that's when he realized that Tracy had lied and had probably just dumped their pets somewhere. So that's really cruel.
Sure is.
I guess, is that passive-aggressive when you hurt someone's pets to get at them, or?
Yeah.
I guess, but it does seem very blatantly aggressive to the poor animals.
It didn't work out for them, did it?
But apparently she had no attachment to them, and they were supposed to be her pets.
She had no attachment to anybody.
True.
Or anything.
That's true.
So John is getting increasingly worried about what Tracy might have been planning to do against him. and he decided to call the private investigator his parents had used when they were looking into their credit card theft. So he explained to the investigator what was going on, the gunshot into the ceiling, strange people Tracy's hanging around with. Some of the same men John had come home to find in his apartment with Tracy while he was out. The credit card issues and the whole thing about life insurance.
Yeah, but like I said, at that point, she didn't care. She didn't care what he thought.
Oh, obviously not, did
she? No, not at all. And it only took 2 days for the investigator to come back with news. Tracy had spent 2 nights in one guy's apartment, and this guy was described as a bodybuilder type. The private investigator had photos of the two of them kissing, holding hands, and definitely acting like they were lovers. Tracy was observed coming and going all day long from various apartments, restaurants, gyms, meeting different men at different places. Sometimes she'd be dressed as though she was a high-class call girl, but other times she'd have a blue duffel bag and just be wearing sweatpants and a t-shirt. John wound up leaving Denver because he was afraid Tracy was plotting to kill him. John's PI called him one night and said, "Hey, listen, Mr. Pittman, you need to be careful. Tracy's going to try and get you alone inside your apartment." And John said okay and asked the investigator to explain to him. And what he found out was that Tracy wasn't only screwing around and becoming involved in all sorts of bad activities, but the people she surrounded herself were really involved in what he called the underbelly of society. Street hoods, he called them, hustlers. And they were acting as though they were going to come into some money. They were going out, sometimes with Tracy, and test driving expensive trucks and cars and motorcycles, but not one of them had a job, apparently. So the PI warned John not to go home after work one day. Tracy had called John and said she was waiting for him at home, but she was actually walking right then in the opposite direction of the apartment. So what had happened is she had some male friends who were going to be inside the apartment waiting for John, and they would have killed him by injecting illicit narcotics into his body, the PI believed. So John didn't go back, and he left right then for Chicago. So we can see she's escalating quickly.
She certainly is.
Yeah.
What a sweetheart.
Well, now might be a good time to take a minute and talk about our sponsors.
Yeah, I need to take a time out from this case. And what we're talking about is only probably a tenth of the stuff she did.
Oh, yeah, there's so much I read about that we couldn't go into it all. It'd have to be a 10-parter.
It would.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just each page you turn, you shake your head in amazement and say, I just can't believe she's doing this stuff.
Yeah, we probably could have done just a podcast on her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's take a moment for our sponsors.
Sure.
So, Jill, are you ready for the body of your dreams?
Absolutely.
PVOLV's streaming service offers a large library of premium videos, including structured workout plans and new videos that are updated weekly. As a user, you can stream to sculpt, tone, and define your body anytime, anywhere, from any device.
It's very convenient.
PVOLV's revolutionary prehab approach elongates and creates lean muscles, eliminating bulk to sculpt and define your body. PVOLV has a simple, brilliant tool called the P-Ball, which targets your core, glutes, and thighs. The P-Ball has a comfortable plastic band that holds the ball where you need it to activate those hard-to-reach muscles and help you get the shape you want. PVOLV has a bunch of streaming programs you can use on your phone, iPad, or laptop, including the 30-day challenge, the 6-day total body, and the 3-day body burn. Also, the personalized features allow you to track your progress, stay motivated, and keep on schedule.
Yeah, now I streamed PVOLV to my computer so I can work out right in my office/recording studio at home. The P-Ball really seems like a simple thing, but it actually does make a big difference, Dick. I use it for my PVOLV 30-day challenge, which I have accepted wholeheartedly. In 30 days, we're going to be out west, and I want to look decent in my shorts, sundresses, and when I'm poolside. So with PVOLV, I feel confident, and I feel like I'm up to the challenge.
So to get your 30 days of free streaming, visit pvolv.com/brewery and enter brewery at checkout. That's pvolv.com/brewery and promo code brewery to get 30 days of free streaming videos. pvolve.com/brewery.
Awesome. Thanks, PVOLV. This episode is also sponsored by Shudder. AMC Network Shudder is a premium streaming video service for fans of everything from thrillers to suspense to true horror. So I think a lot of our listeners would be into this kind of thing, like I am. I really love the spine-tingling thrillers, the shocking horrors, and the edge-of-your-seat suspense films. Now, I'm not big on gore for gore's sake, but for my money, there really isn't anything better than a good, suspenseful thriller. Shudder has everything from recent blockbusters to classics, like the wonderful The Night of the Living Dead. And they also have an extensive international library, which I really can't wait to tap into. With Shudder, you can stream the terrifying movies you love with any of your favorite devices. And it's worked on every device we have, including iPad, Android, iPhones, Roku, and even Apple TV. Shudder also has original movies and series, which I thought was really cool. And one of their recent exclusive films is Mayhem, which stars Steven Yeun, otherwise known as Glenn from The Walking Dead. We've missed him ever since he died. Spoiler on The Walking Dead, but ever since he died on The Walking Dead, we've missed him.
Yeah, but he narrowly escaped death in a contrived killing.
Yeah, before he was beaten before with the bat.
Right.
Now, we also watched what? We watched The Reef.
Yeah.
We watched that last night.
That was pretty cool, actually.
It was. It was like an Australian combination of Jaws and Open Water, which were both great movies. You know, I love the shark movies. And over the weekend, we watched that really terrifying movie called Them. And that was a foreign film, wasn't it?
It was.
Do you know where that was from?
Eastern Europe, I think.
Yeah. It was scary, though.
It was pretty creepy.
Yeah. I mean, that scared me to the point where I was afraid to get out of the bed to use the bathroom in the middle of the night. So we had to sleep with extra lights on.
We did.
Yeah. Now, Shudder's a good deal, too. It's only $4.99 a month or $49.99 for an entire year. It's totally ad-free and very user-friendly. You can search for content not only by title, actor, or genre, but by things like, do you prefer vampire flicks, zombie flicks, or the more realistic thrillers like, you know, Silence of the Lambs, things like that. So Shudder is like Netflix for those of us who really like to be terrified. And they have a new collection out now that seems really interesting. It's called 30 of the Best Horror Films You Won't Find on Netflix. So if you want to try Shudder, you can try it free for 30 days by going to shudder.com/podcast and using our promo code BREWERY. That's shudder.com/podcast. And our promo code is BREWERY. I think you might really enjoy it. I would give it a try. I mean, there's nothing to lose.
No. I mean, you get a month's free trial, right?
I never say no to that.
How can you beat that?
You can't.
And you can put a lot of movie watching into that month.
Absolutely. Yeah, but you'll be terrified to move. You'll be sitting on the couch afraid to move if you keep watching those movies.
Well, we'll watch some less terrifying ones.
Yeah. They do have a wide variety. They're not all terrifying.
Yeah, there's a ton of things.
Yeah. Thanks, Shudder.
While in Chicago, John had his private investigator continue surveillance and reporting back to him. Now, Tracy moved around a lot. So on several occasions, the PI followed her into adult bookstores, where she'd spend time buying sex toys and condoms and oils. Good for the condoms.
Yeah.
And then head off to a motel where a man would soon meet her. She'd spend a few hours inside, the man would leave. She would then meet different men and either spend the night at their apartment or just a few hours and then leave. She'd meet men on the beach. One time she'd been seen arguing with a man inside his vehicle in a beach parking lot. She got out, walked towards a boat where four men waited for her, one of whom patted her on the butt as she stepped into the boat. So he's getting these reports. He's getting more and more disturbed.
So there's something wrong with her.
Well, there is. She but there's something wrong with him.
Well, yeah.
How can you put up with this for this length of time?
True, but I mean, there's something seriously wrong with her.
Well.
She's doing weird things.
I think we've gotten inklings and more than inklings of that in the past.
Right. I mean, I would agree he's too passive in this, but she's super disturbed. So John moved into an apartment near Northwestern Memorial Hospital, where he was working on his plastic surgeon residency. And he realized this marriage is over. There's no resurrecting this after she's sleeping with all these men and lying to him about everything. So as an interim legal separation agreement, John and Tracy decided they would share custody of Bert. But almost from the first visit, Tracy said that John would not adhere to the rules that they had settled upon. She said John never dropped Bert off on time, She said the last thing she wanted to do was make him unhappy because she was afraid of him. So this was the beginning of Tracy's really dangerous campaign to destroy John. She's saying everything negative about him that she can.
Yeah, it's like it became her mission in life to do him in. Just totally destroy him.
And she did something that I find a lot of liars and manipulators do, and it's things that were true about her. She would put on other people and accuse them of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Kind of projected onto something else.
Did a lot of that. She did, yeah.
Before they were divorced in 1996, Tracy accused John of sexually abusing then 3-year-old Bert. Tracy's trying hard to destroy John's reputation. Now, she even printed out flyers saying that he was a child molester, and she put them on car windshields in the employee parking lot at the hospital where John worked. A judge eventually dismissed the case for lack of evidence, but this didn't occur until Bert had undergone extensive psychological and physical testing. Following the divorce, Tracy and Bert moved back to Chicago.
Now, some of this behavior is the phrase cutting off your nose to spite your face, because why would you want to destroy his career when your son is going to benefit from the money he earns, which would indirectly benefit you? So if she destroyed his career, she'd lose money on that, and her son would definitely lose money.
That's right.
But I guess she's just so angry and hateful, she doesn't care, all I can figure.
Yeah, no, I don't have any other explanation for that.
No. So in 1997, Tracy met and began dating Dr. Joseph Laspisa, a Chicago-based oral surgeon. So she worked for him and ended up taking advantage of him for quite a while. One thing she did was convince him to give her access to his electronic signature. So she used this to get her hands on controlled medications. She also convinced him to use nitrous oxide with her during a so-called sexual interlude. And he allowed her to start an IV and inject him with Versed. So that relationship ended when, after an attempt to extort $150,000 from him, she accused him of sexual assault. And although he was later exonerated, this scandal cost him his dental practice. So she got in there working, got access to computers, convinced him to do all these different things, got money from him, and then convinced him to have sex with her, and sometimes when they'd have sex, she'd put him under. And Versed, that takes away your short-term memory, so he had no idea what happened.
Yeah, I have little sympathy for him.
Well, he was pretty stupid.
He was more than pretty stupid. I'm just amazed. So he paid for it dearly.
He absolutely did, yes. And he made bad choices.
He certainly did.
He really did.
So while she's having this sexual relationship with Dr. Laspisa, Tracy met an Australian man online. It's actually an online Christian dating site.
Yes, he was very religious.
This guy was named Michael Roberts. So Tracy used the dental practice credit card. Here's another example of her brazen behavior. Tracy used the dental practice credit card to pay for a trip to Australia, and she promptly married Michael Roberts, bringing him back to the United States. So this was like a really whirlwind.
Oh yeah, I think they knew
each other.
I
wouldn't even say romance. They meet online, 2-3 weeks later, they're married.
Yeah, it was quick.
Very quick.
And then he came back to the U.S. with her.
Right. And they moved to Early, Iowa. It's a little tiny town of just a couple thousand.
Really?
It's very small.
Very small. Yeah, I'm not sure why they moved there. She had said that it was Michael's choice because it was a good place to raise a family, but it's kind of a strange choice. I don't know how they came up with that.
Yeah. His job allowed him to work from home or work from wherever he wanted to. So why not Early?
I guess.
I mean, I guess you could say why Early, but yeah, why not?
Right.
So Michael ran a computer business of some sort from an office that they built next door to their house. Neighbor Mona Weedy was a real estate agent, but she also did some side work for Michael.
Yeah, Mona's 20-year-old son, Dustin, was kind of an awkward young man, and he had difficulty keeping a job. He had been labeled as special needs in school, but Mona believed that he was actually quite gifted with computers, so maybe a bit of a savant.
I get the impression from the stuff we read that he was kind of
on the spectrum,
autism spectrum kid.
Yeah.
And had a special knack for computers.
Yeah. So after Dustin lost his job at the nearby ethanol plant, Michael offered to take Dustin under his wing. So Michael was a very religious guy, and he often preached to Dustin about being saved. And Dustin wasn't really interested in that, but he kind of went along with it because he loved to go paintballing with Michael and Bert, because Bert lives with them, of course. So as Mona worked for Michael and Tracy in the year 2000, she experienced their lives from a very personal perspective. And she thought they were an average couple. 3 kids, a dog, a nice home, and they spent their weekends together. She thought Michael was a bit preachy and pushy with his Christian values, but he wasn't really hurting anyone. So she was okay with that. But Mona grew suspicious of Tracy and Robert while working for them in the fall of 2001. She felt that there were things going on with the business that she just didn't understand. Her daughter was also babysitting for Tracy and Michael occasionally, and she would report back some odd things going on inside the house. Things like there was no milk or, you know, just basic weird things, kind of neglectful things.
Or housekeeping not being done, and it was a dirty house. There's all sorts of little...
just a little weirdness.
Little weird stuff.
Yeah. So Mona tried to keep her distance while still maintaining a positive working relationship with the couple. Now, she'd opened her own real estate office, but business was slow in the spring through to the fall of 2001, so she relied on this part-time income she was making from Michael's business. Mona worked mornings for Michael, and then in the afternoons she worked for herself. She seemed to kind of have a hard time explaining the work she was doing for Michael because she was unsure of what he was actually doing. All she knew was that the company was selling some sort of computer-based training courses, and her job was to search for new customers. And she thought at that point that Michael and Tracy seemed to get along pretty well, but they did have some issues, including the stress of the business and also this ongoing custody battle over Bert with John Pittman. That just never seemed to end.
No, that was ongoing.
Yep. And Tracy was not going to let it go.
No. So on December 12th, Tracy called Mona to ask if Dustin could come over and do some work for her. Now, Dustin was standing beside Mona in the kitchen as she spoke to Tracy. And the previous day, Mona's daughter had said something about Tracy asking her if her mom minded Dustin coming over to do some work for her and Michael. Dustin had been out of work since being fired from the ethanol plant. And Mona tried to tell Tracy that it might be a mistake to hire her son because he is not reliable or efficient. But Tracy told her to send him over the next day. "We'll see how it goes," Tracy said. "And please, Mona, don't you come with him. He's 20 years old, for crying out loud. Just send him down on his own."
Which makes sense. I'm okay with that.
That part does.
Yeah.
Mona hung up, thinking, well, these are wealthy people. It would really help out if Dustin had a job. And the more she thought about it, the better Mona felt about it. So she told Dustin to go over the next day after his orthodontist appointment.
So on the day Dustin was murdered, December 13th, which was the next day, 2001, Michael Roberts and one of his employees were out of state, traveling for what they called an emergency business meeting in Denver and Minneapolis. So Tracy was at home with her 3 kids. She had 2 little kids with Michael, and she had Bert from her marriage to John. And Michael had been gone for almost a week. He was expected home after midnight, early on the 14th or that night of the 13th, however you want to look at it. Mona had work to finish up in her office and wanted to do some Christmas shopping in Sioux City. Before she left, Mona spoke to her daughter and made sure that Dustin was up and had left for his orthodontist appointment. After hanging up, she did a few things around her office, and she left for her shopping trip. At Tracy's house, 2 neighbors stopped by to feed the dog and cat, but Tracy told them she'd already done it, so they left. After that, Tracy said Dustin stopped by, and she said she wasn't sure of the time, but we know it had to be after 2 p.m. because he had his orthodontist appointment at 1. Tracy contradicted what Mona would say about the conversation she had with Tracy on the 12th. Tracy said that Dustin stopped by, all on his own, to ask if she had any work for him, telling her that he needed money. So it was after 7 p.m., we know, on December 13th, when Bert called 911, saying some men had broken into their home. Bert and his 2 younger siblings, who were like 3 and 1 year old, they were very little, were upstairs in a bedroom throughout this whole incident, but Bert would claim to have witnessed a man strangling his mother with a pair of pantyhose and another larger man running from the house. As soon as Bert began talking about the pantyhose, Tracy interrupted him, changing the subject, and asking if the man she had shot was her husband, Michael. Bert said, "No, I think it's Dustin Weedy." So this was an odd statement on Tracy's part. She would have known if it was Michael upstairs lying on the floor dead. In fact, in all of what she said later about when the intruders came into the house, she knew it wasn't Michael, as she was standing on top of the stairs staring down at these men coming up at her. So why would she ask if it was Michael? There were so many contradictions. The chief investigator on the scene told one of the other officers to start interviewing Tracy and the children while he cleared the rest of the house. A deputy told Bert to sit down at the dining room table, and Tracy and the other kids followed. But before he could get started talking to Bert, Tracy interrupted the conversation and said she was having trouble swallowing. Now, she had a red mark on her neck, right?
Right. She was claiming to have been strangled.
But it didn't really look like strangling where you'd have bruises. It looked more like a rug burn, like she just kind of rubbed the pantyhose around her neck, right, or something.
This is what they were looking at in the hospital when they took her there. So the police allowed emergency medical services to come into the house and examine Tracy. Investigators looked upstairs, and as they entered Tracy's bedroom, they saw the dead man on the floor in a fetal position with a pool of blood coagulating already around his head. The smell of gunpowder was unusually strong in the air. Around the doorway into Tracy's bedroom were numerous empty shell cases on the floor. This was clearly the area where Tracy had stood and fired the weapon, unless she had moved the cases. There was a large spatter area on the north wall and floor northeast of the body. So it appeared that Dustin had been shot after his blood had already coagulated on the floor, spraying partially clotted blood onto the walls.
That's not right.
So this is important stuff.
Yes, absolutely. So it was 7:22 p.m. when police made a request for the lab team to come out to the residence and process the scene. Downstairs, Tracy again asked if the man she had shot to death was Michael, and she was becoming hysterical, breathing heavily as if she was hyperventilating. While speaking to Tracy, the investigator noticed the red mark around her neck, like a friction burn, and Bert kept saying it was Dustin Weedy upstairs on the floor. So if Bert knew this was Dustin, why didn't Tracy? It's like she's pretending not to know. Tracy told the investigators that she shot him while he was choking her with the pantyhose. She said she made her way to the gun cabinet and was able to get the gun out and shoot him in an upward motion. She said that the gun cabinet was locked and she was able to open it, and she removed two guns and shot the man who was attacking her. Tracy also kept repeating that Michael should have been back by then. But according to Tracy's friend, Michael wasn't expected back until about 2 a.m., and Tracy had known this. So upstairs, EMTs had unofficially declared Dustin Weedy deceased. It was clear Dustin had been dead for some time. The blood around Dustin's head had a dark, almost black color to it, as though he'd been shot in the head some time ago. And the blood had time to drain out of him and coagulate, so that takes some time.
Yes, it does.
The last shot she fired had blown the coagulated blood around Dustin's head onto the wall. So the blood had time to clot, which, that's like several minutes, right? That takes a while.
Takes some time, that's right.
So when Tracy said that he had been rocking and trying to get back up on his feet, and that's why she'd shot again, that couldn't have been true because Dustin had already been shot twice in the back of his head, and the blood from his head had pooled and actually clotted on the floor. So there's no way that Dustin was trying to get up when she did those final shots.
Very unlikely. So Mona Weedy was on her way home from Christmas shopping when she got a call on her cell phone. This was her nephew. Now, he never called her cell phone. Not once.
No, nope, so, this was unusual. Unheard of, actually.
The nephew told her that there had been a shooting at the Roberts' house. Mona thought that Michael must have shot Tracy, or Tracy must have shot Michael. They had guns all over their house. Add to that their troubled marriage, and it was not that shocking that one of them would have snapped. So Mona drives home. She calls Brett, her husband. Brett was about 10 blocks away from the Roberts house at the time, inside his workshop. It was loud inside the garage, and he hadn't heard anything. So Mona gets to her house and walks in. Her daughter and her daughter's boyfriend are sitting in the living room. Mona sat down and they talked about their day. Now, after about 20 minutes, Brett came racing through the back door, frantic, asking if Dustin was home. Neither Mona nor her daughter had been downstairs where Dustin usually spent his time.
Yeah, they weren't sure, but what happened is Brett had seen Dustin's car parked right outside the Roberts house, so he freaked out.
Understandably.
So Mona and Brett hopped into her car and drove down to the Roberts house, which was just a couple of miles away. Moments later, they were parked in front of the house. There was yellow crime scene tape placed around it now. Four cops had surrounded their son's car. Mona ran over and broke down. She learned right then and there that her 20-year-old son was dead. After doctors checked out Tracy, she sat with Detective Dennis Sesford and told her story of what happened. Her parents arrived and said they'd take her to their house in Rembrandt, which was about 30 minutes north of Early. Tracy offered to the detective, out of the blue, that she believed one of the intruders had used the bathroom upstairs. She said she'd heard the toilet flush. She thought maybe it was early in the incident, she said. So why was this statement from Tracy about the bathroom important for him to examine? Beyond being kind of crazy on the surface that a home invader would stop in the middle of a violent, usually sexually motivated crime to use the toilet, the fact that Tracy recalled this while in the hospital and at the tail end of her interview said a lot to the detective. Supposedly, Tracy had been viciously attacked in her home by two men, and then she'd said it was three men. She said she'd fought these men because her children were at great risk of being harmed. And one of the intruders, according to Tracy's account, strangled her with a set of pantyhose. She then shot 11 rounds and killed that man. So because police later believed that Tracy had Dustin write in a journal about being hired to kill her by her ex-husband John Pittman, police thought it was probable that when she was having him write in the journal, he'd probably had to use the bathroom. So she might have thought that evidence of Dustin having used the bathroom, like fecal DNA or fingerprints on the toilet upstairs, would show that he had been in the house. So maybe she thought that was an important thing to say at that point.
Yeah, I guess that's why she decided to insert that into the story, because there's no really any reason to talk about that.
No, and it's really unbelievable to me that someone breaking into a home would use the bathroom.
No, right?
Very odd. So when asked if she had enemies, Tracy brought up the dentist who she tried to extort. Her suit against him, interestingly enough, had been settled just 2 days before the shooting.
Very interesting.
So I wonder about that.
In talking with Dustin's parents, police tried to determine why Dustin was at the Roberts' house. According to Tracy, Dustin had shown up earlier, around 4:30, and then returned, busted in, and had a plan to harm her and the kids. By this point, a pink journal had been found inside Dustin's car next to a junky computer and a keyboard that was from the Roberts house. That journal, in Dustin's handwriting, spelled out a motive on his part. Dr. Pittman, through his lawyer, had hired Dustin to kill his former wife and son. Now, no one in law enforcement shared the contents of the journal.
Well, no, they want to keep that under wraps.
Absolutely.
Which turned out to be a good idea.
It's a big help that they kept it under wraps.
But it seemed totally unreasonable that Dr. Pittman would have hired Dustin to kill his wife, even if he wanted to hire someone to kill her. Why would he hire this 20-year-old? He doesn't even know him. There's no evidence that he ever even spoke to him. Mona later confirmed that she had spoken to Tracy about Dustin working for them in the days before Dustin's death. If they believe Tracy, the incident lasted for over 45 minutes. But when you look at when Dustin left his house and when the 911 call came in, it really could have been much longer than that. This was a huge red flag. Home invasions normally last minutes, definitely not hours. Between 5:30 and 7 p.m. was the time frame. Now, another odd thing was that Tracy didn't take Bert to his usual basketball practice. She and Bert talked about basketball practice in their statements, but no one asked them why they never went. Bert said they would usually leave about 6:45 p.m., which, according to Tracy's timeline, that would have been before the home invasion would have begun.
Yeah, so for some reason, they didn't go to practice.
Right.
Now, there's other important questions. Why would a hired killer go to a murder without a murder weapon? Why would Dustin park right in the driveway for everyone to see?
And he had things in his car he could have brought in with him if he was there to commit a crime. Like there was a wrench, there was rope, there was all kinds of stuff.
There was.
But why would he go in there and use her pantyhose? How would he even know he'd find them?
Exactly.
And like you said, why would he park there? Wouldn't he park somewhere else?
Yeah, he'd park somewhere else and approach the house on foot. right?
And, yeah, and even more improbable, why would Dustin leave a confession in this journal on the front seat of his car? Doesn't make any sense.
No.
Also,
unless someone wanted that to be found, right?
Exactly.
And why would Dustin steal a computer that was in really crappy shape and in worse shape than the one he already owned?
Yeah, and there were no signs of a struggle on Dustin's body, just the multiple gunshots. And based on what was in the journal, how would Dr. Pittman even know Dustin? A really important piece of the staging was that the kids were up in a room watching a movie, so Bert was the only real witness Tracy had to worry about. There were no signs of forced entry, no signs of a struggle, or any signs of a robbery, other than that junky computer in Dustin's car. The only sign of a disturbance upstairs was in the master bedroom, and this is where Dustin had been murdered. In their first statements, Tracy and Bert talked a lot about banging around, wrestling with intruders, Tracy fighting them off, kicking at Bert's bedroom door, her shoving one of them into a wall. But not one family photo was crooked on the walls, and not one throw rug was even wrinkled. So it didn't look like any kind of a struggle had happened.
No struggle going on there.
It didn't look like it.
The scientific evidence at the scene told a chilling story. They had found 7 shell cases in the southeast corner of the bedroom near the gun safe. Most of these 7 shots hit Dustin Weedy. According to Tracy, she had fired in the dark on her knees, falling over herself, after having gotten the gun safe to pop open after a couple failed attempts to open it. The hammer on the gun jammed. Dustin grabbed at her or choked her with a pantyhose, and she was still able to hit him by blind firing. And all these shots hit him.
Yeah, so, she didn't miss.
So her statement is kind of that she shot over her shoulder.
Yeah, actually. But there was no stippling on her face and no damage to her ear from shooting right next to her face is what she said.
So the CSI team did a reconstruction of the shots while in the bedroom with Dustin's body still on site. And what they found raised questions about Tracy's version of the events. The trajectory of the wounds through the body were consistent with a person shooting from a standing position near the bedroom door while Dustin was lying on the floor. So it seemed that Tracy had stood over Dustin, firing his rounds into the back of his head. The blood spatter on the wall and drawers of Tracy's dresser showed that shots had been fired from at least 2 different locations, spreading already coagulated blood.
Yeah, so it's just amazing with all this that it took them so long to bring her to trial. But despite Dustin's parents confirming that the journal was actually in his handwriting, detectives couldn't find any evidence that Dustin and Dr. Pittman had ever even met. The police never considered John a suspect. While detectives didn't believe Tracy's story about the shooting, prosecutor didn't bring charges against her right away. Dustin's parents had to live with the fact that their son had been murdered as part of Tracy's plot to frame her ex-husband. Their son was dead and their lives are ruined, destroyed. Just 5 days after the shooting, also, Tracy and her family went on a 2-week vacation to Australia. Police believe she planned the shooting to be just before this planned trip, so she'd have time alone with Bert to secure her version of events. So that's diabolical.
It is. But she's going to work on her son.
But just the plotting and cold-bloodedness of this.
Can you believe it?
It's amazing.
Yeah, and they don't really go into that much detail on why the prosecutors elected not to charge her with anything.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there was some turnover in the county attorney's office, and there wasn't enough evidence at the time, despite the one investigator's pleas. There didn't seem to be enough evidence to charge her.
Yeah.
So they let it slide.
Yeah, which is amazing because there's so much...
It sure is.
So many questionable things.
Again, the sources we looked at, it's all retrospective stuff, and who knows what was going on at the time. But there sure seems like enough evidence to charge her.
Yeah, it seems like somebody definitely dropped the ball.
It does.
And as if this Weedy family hadn't suffered enough, 9 months later, Dustin's father killed himself right at Dustin's gravesite. So that family has imploded. She's destroyed these people's lives.
She certainly has.
Completely.
So Tracy and Michael separated, and Tracy and her kids moved to Omaha, Nebraska. And in the meantime, the authorities in Iowa kept the existence of the pink notebook secret. In 2002, Tracy appeared on the Montel Williams Show as an example of a courageous mother who had to use deadly force to protect her children. In response to questions in front of the studio audience, Tracy told the story of how she had no choice but to take this intruder's life to save herself and her children. And she came off as a hero.
Yeah, there were interviews on the local news in that area as well with this heroic mother. She has no conscience.
Now, in 2004, after Tracy and Michael Roberts were divorced, Tracy told the police that her second husband had been a part of Dr. Pittman's conspiracy to have her killed. So we're adding a new layer to this story.
Well, now Michael's on the outs, and once you're out with her, you're her target.
You're nothing to me.
So she's targeted him big time.
So the authorities still weren't believing this murder-for-hire theory, and they never considered Michael a suspect in Dustin's homicide. While she's living in Nebraska, Tracy did run into some trouble with the law. In 2009, among other accusations of criminal deceit, she is convicted of welfare fraud and passport fraud, but was sentenced to probation only.
So this, to me, is another instance of a white, middle-class woman getting away with things that a poorer person or a minority or a man would never get away with.
That could be.
I mean, it's just crazy.
Don't forget to throw in attractive white person.
Right. I think that helps, too. It just shows you where our society is, because she got away with so much. Crazy.
She sure did.
So I guess when they really started coming back and getting things together to prosecute her was in 2010, when Ben Smith, the new county prosecutor in early Iowa, took office.
Sac County, Iowa. As he had promised in his campaign, Smith asked the Iowa Division of Criminal Justice to investigate this almost 10-year-old cold case. And as part of that investigation, a forensic ballistics expert determined that Dustin had been shot 3 times in the back as he lay on the bedroom floor. So in the prosecutor's opinion, evidence was inconsistent with Tracy's claim of self-defense.
Well, duh. I mean, to me, come on, it seems obvious. Well, at the conclusion of the state's investigation, Ben Smith charged Tracy with first-degree murder. Under Smith's theory of the case, Tracy had lured Dustin to her house, forced him at gunpoint to write in the pink notebook that Dr. John Pittman had hired him to kill her and her son, fired 9 shots into his body, then planted the notebook in his car in order to frame her former husband, Dr. Pittman, for a solicitation of murder. So poor Dustin had just been a pawn in her evil scheme to win the custody battle that she was having with Bert's father. Tracy was really one of the most cold-blooded sociopathic killers in recent history that anyone could think of. She was an extremely dangerous woman. There were also people that theorized that she didn't hold him at gunpoint, but she used her sexuality to lure him and talk him into doing it. He was very naive for a 20-year-old. She could have talked him into doing anything for her, really. It wouldn't have been hard.
No, it wouldn't have been.
No.
Yeah, I think emotionally or relationship-wise, Dustin was a pretty naive kid.
Absolutely. I think so. Tracy's attorney asked for and was granted a change of venue. Her murder trial began in October 2011 in Fort Dodge, Iowa. She was 45 at that time and living in Omaha. And she had the complete support of her 20-year-old son, Bert, and the new man that she was engaged to marry.
I'm thinking, if I'm this new fiancé, I'm running for the nearest exit.
Well, no,
but
not at all. And Bert, he's under her spell, I guess. I just can't imagine how he could have a normal life after what he's been through.
No, I don't see how.
She's really damaged him.
So the jury of 6 men and 6 women rejected Tracy's self-defense contract murder story, and she was found guilty of first-degree murder. And in January of 2012, Tracy was sentenced to life in prison.
Now, before her sentencing, Tracy sent a letter to a Wisconsin prison inmate who'd been convicted of sexually molesting a 12-year-old girl. Now, I don't know how she ended up in contact with him, but I guess he'd written to her after her conviction and offered her some moral support, whatever that means. But anyway, her letter to the convicted sex offender included personal information about Michael Roberts. She gave him Michael's Social Security number, date of birth, physical description, and home address. And then Michael was warned that his life was in danger. So Michael ended up pretty much on the run with his kids for years as she tried to destroy his life. In June 2012, Tracy was on a Dateline NBC two-hour special about the Dustin Wheaty murder case, and she stuck to her story of self-defense. Bert was on the show, and he supported her account of the shooting. From her Iowa prison, Tracy filed a child custody case with Michael Roberts over the two younger children, and by then they were 12 and 14 years old. Michael had the children with him in California, and he planned to escape by moving his family back to Australia. On September 2012, Iowa judge Nancy Wittenberg ruled that despite Tracy's murder conviction, she had not lost her right to regular visits with her children. So Michael was actually forced by law to make visitation trips from California to Iowa with the kids, or he'd be held in contempt and he could go to jail. So that's quite a situation. That's kind of unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah, what's our extradition treaty with Australia? I mean, my thinking would be get on the plane with the kids and go to Australia and make them try to get you back.
Yeah, I don't know.
But
I don't
know
how that works. But also in July of 2014, investigators in Iowa ended up searching Tracy's mother's computer, and that was on suspicion that Anna Richter, her mother, and Tracy had harassed and defamed Dr. John Pittman and other prosecution witnesses. So the people who had helped to convict her, basically. And according to the search warrant, Anna and Tracy accused the witnesses of theft, perjury, fraud, computer hacking, and child molestation. That seems to be her go-to, is to accuse people of child molestation, which, that's just despicable. That's a horrible thing to make up. In August 2014, Ann Richter's attorney argued that her client's computer contained attorney-client privileged information, and she asked the court for a hearing to review the contents of her computer. So she didn't end up going to prison at all. But it's just amazing to me how Tracy's family has supported her.
They circled the wagons.
Yeah.
Right?
Now, as far as media on this case, there's the Dateline episode. There's a Diabolical episode, which I can't think of anyone who's more suited for that series than her.
No kidding.
There's also a great book called Beautifully Cruel by M. William Phelps, which goes into all the details. There's a great interview if you want to find it on YouTube. It's called A Father's Fight. It's Australian 60 Minutes show with an interview with Michael Roberts. And I'll put that link in our show notes. That includes an interview with Michael from 2012. Now, he had married Tracy just 18 days after they met in person, so I don't know. That wasn't very smart.
And he also claimed that just 2 months after they moved to America, Tracy was already having an affair. He said that in March 2004, Tracy took out a $1 million life insurance policy on him. Then a few days later, she attempted to murder him. She drugged him, put a plastic bag over his head as he was rolled up under bed sheets. He was luckily able to wake up and escape. We played that in the intro.
Yeah, amazing.
In 2012, the youngest son begged his mother to let them go. Michael appeared the court order, but he was unsuccessful. Now, he's been sentenced to jail twice for 30 days for not bringing the children to visit Tracy.
He said he had to live in hiding because Tracy had family members who were threatening his life. And each time Tracy's family found out where he was living, they'd go after him. Tracy's father had been a Chicago policeman, and her brother was also a Chicago detective. During her trial, he had claimed that Michael had threatened his life and tried to get him locked up. So that family's been relentless. Really trying to destroy Michael's life, he said.
It's amazing.
So I'm not sure what's going on now. The kids are adults now, so hopefully it's behind them now. But in 2012, it seemed like he was really going through hell.
Yeah, doesn't it?
It does. So before we get to listener feedback, Dick, let's give a big thank you to our listeners, to our TigraBber members, and our Patreon supporters. Also to everyone who takes the time to write to us or leave us a voicemail. You can leave us a voicemail on our website, tigraber.com, or you can also record your feedback on your phone and email it to us at truecrimebrewery@tigraber.com. If listening to True Crime Brewery is a positive little part in your life and you'd enjoy an extra episode to listen to once in a while, you can offer your support by joining Team Tigraber at tigraber.com or by becoming a patron at patreon.com/truecrimebrewery. And as a member, you'll get access to our whole backlog of members-only episodes, plus the new ones we release every month. These are full-length episodes that we put just as much effort into for our members. So when you join, it really helps to pay for the costs of producing and distributing the show, and we will send you gifts. So that's a pretty good deal.
Isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Some other ways to offer us some support is to follow us on Twitter at TieGrabberPods, on Instagram, or on Facebook. Also, if you take a few minutes to leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to the podcast, that helps out a lot. Now, on our members only, we just did a couple of good ones. We did the one on Jill Cahill.
Yeah, New York State. That was pretty interesting. He tried to kill her twice.
He was diabolical.
Yes.
Yes. And then we have coming up Clara Harris, where she killed her husband with the Mercedes, driving over him several times. He was cheating on her. They were both dentists. So that'll be an interesting one to do. I look forward to that one.
It was.
Coming up within the next week or so.
Yeah, we're working on it as we speak.
Okay. Well, why don't we do our voicemails first?
Okay. So the first voicemail we have is from Lynn from Pennsylvania about the Kathy Augustine murder.
Hi, Jill and Dick. This is Lynn from Pennsylvania. On the murder of Kathy Augustine, I was interested to note that when the paramedics arrived, she was still on the bed, even though Chaz said he had been performing CPR. It seems to me that a qualified nurse would have moved her to the floor to perform CPR.
Good.
Love your show. Thanks.
Good point, Lynn. And we had noticed that in the sources we researched and just didn't mention it in the podcast, but obviously if you're doing CPR, you're doing it on a hard, firm surface.
That's a big red flag, because he was supposed to be this really skilled nurse.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So thanks, Lynn.
Thanks for the comment. Then we have Catherine from Connecticut, who has a beer recommendation.
Oh, all right. Let's hear that one.
Hi, guys. My name is Catherine. I'm from Connecticut, not nearly as cool as Australia, but I absolutely love your podcast, and I'm a type 1 diabetic, so shout out to Dick for being an endocrinologist. I don't have a case recommendation, but I have a beer one. It's a Pennsylvania beer. It's Golden Monkey by Victory Brewing, and it's one of my favorites. So if you have another Pennsylvania case coming up, give it a shot. And love you guys. I think you do a great job. Thanks for making the podcast. Bye.
Thank you, Catherine. Golden Monkey certainly is a great beer. I've had a fair number of beers from Victory, and I pretty much liked them all. But Golden Monkey is one of the better ones.
Yeah.
So thanks for the recommendation.
All right.
And if we do another case from Pennsylvania, that would certainly be one of the strong contenders.
I'm sure we will.
Why not?
Yeah, I love a good beer suggestion. Thanks, Catherine. Who do we have next?
Next.
We've gotten quite a few voicemails, by the way. Thanks, guys.
Next, we have a voicemail from Elsa in Bellingham, Washington.
All right, and this is a case suggestion.
And we have a case suggestion.
Awesome. Here we go.
Hi, Dick and Jill. I am inspired to leave a voicemail after hearing one left on the last episode from a fellow Bellinghamster up here in Washington. I just love the show, and I feel strange to leave a recommendation because I actually kind of like the surprise of not knowing. But from our own local area, I think another really interesting case is one of a young girl named Hanna Williams, who was from Cedral Woolley, Washington, which is just down the road from here. And she was a 13-year-old adopted from Ethiopia, and essentially her adopted family, I think you could say, starved her to death, just maltreatment, awful stuff. But what is also really upsetting to me was the lack of attention I thought it got from the community. And I think even to this day, just a few years later, you mentioned this girl and not a lot of people know her story. So I think it would be wonderful to look at that and kind of bring her story to light in just even a small way. So thanks so much for listening, and thank you so much for your show. It's a lovely way to spend our time listening. So thanks so much. Bye.
Thanks, Elsa.
Yeah, and I looked this up. Hanna Williams, who was born Hanna Alemu in Ethiopia, was adopted by Carrie and Larry Williams in 2008. She was adopted from Ethiopia. as she died in 2011 of hypothermia, according to the autopsy, and her adoptive parents were convicted in September 2013. Now, the adoptive father was later convicted of manslaughter, and the wife was convicted of homicide by abuse, and also of first-degree assault of a child for abusing a second Ethiopian adoptee. This child did survive, and he testified against her at the trial.
Now, how does this happen? I feel like if you adopt a child, isn't someone checking up?
I know.
And what about school? Didn't the school say anything? There must have had been signs.
Well, guess what?
What?
She was homeschooled.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. I don't want to get down on homeschooling.
I know. We've gotten in trouble before.
But someone should be checking on the kids if they're not going to school, I feel
like.
To me,
that's a red flag.
Well, I don't know. It means that they're isolated from society, so someone should be checking on them.
Right. Apparently, after being adopted, Hannah was regularly spanked and locked in a closet. She was denied food as punishment. She wasn't allowed to wear clothes, but only a towel, and had to sleep in a barn and take garden hose showers outside.
That's just disgusting. I mean, this child came from a hard life, supposedly supposed to help them, and they do this shit to her? It's disgusting. Isn't it just heartbreaking?
Terribly.
It is terrible.
So this is an interesting one. I think we ought to investigate and maybe do it. Okay. We'll look into that.
Okay.
So thank you, Elsa. This is from Anonymous,
or All right.
Anon, and this is another case suggestion.
All right, let's hear it.
Hi, I'm a devoted listener in California, and I enjoy your give and take discussions very much. I have a suggestion. Just a few minutes ago, I listened to a podcast called, oh nuts, Once Upon a Crime, True Crime, which I found on Apple. Today she did Diane Fossey's murder in Africa, and it was a total fascination, not only because the program was so good, but because the subject matter was something current with which I could relate. I'm thinking maybe you folks would entertain the idea of doing a similar program or a program modeled on that idea for Dennis Peltier, who has been wrongfully in jail for a long time, over 40 years. Dennis Peltier is in jail because of a charge of murder, the murder of two FBI agents on the Wounded Knee Reservation in South Dakota. He was convicted by a jury in Fargo, North Dakota, and has been in jail ever since, even though another person has come forward and admitted to the crime. There's no way he could have done it. It's a very well-researched story, and I'd really enjoy hearing it, as well as having you share it. Thanks for everything. I sure appreciate your show. Bye-bye.
Well, this is a pretty famous case.
Yeah, this has been suggested to us before.
Right. And for people that don't know or don't remember, Peltier is a member of the American Indian Movement, and in 1977 he was convicted and sentenced to two consecutive terms of life imprisonment for first-degree murder in the shooting of two FBI agents during a 1975 conflict on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. Now, his indictment and conviction have been the subject of much controversy. Amnesty International actually placed his case under the unfair trials category in its annual report in 2010. He was eligible for parole in 1993, and his next scheduled parole hearing will be in July 2024, when he's 79 years old.
I was going to say, this guy's not getting any younger.
Right. Now, his last appeal for clemency was rejected by President Barack Obama in January of 2017,
yeah.
And he can apply again for commutation of his sentence in 2018.
But he hasn't done that yet, huh?
Not yet.
Okay.
And barring appeals, parole, or presidential clemency, Peltier will remain in prison for the rest of his life.
Well, geez, he's already been in prison for a good portion of his life.
Well, he's been in prison for the last 40-some years, right? 41
75,
years.
75, yeah.
77, he was convicted.
Yep.
So...
Yeah, I think that's an interesting one, although there are some other wrongful convictions that I really got my eyes set on that would probably come first. Remember that thing we advertised on Starz, Wrong Man?
Yeah.
That had a couple good ones.
Yeah, there's a lot of those.
Yeah. So this can definitely be considered, but there are some other ones that are probably, to be honest, higher on my list. But thank you, Anonymous or Anon. Okay, we have one more voicemail, I believe.
We do. This is from Phoebe.
And this isn't a suggestion, but she was kind enough to send it, so I'm playing it.
Well, it's just one of those complimentary ones.
I know, I have to cringe. All right, ready?
Not cringeworthy.
Hello, Jill and Dick. This is Phoebe from Cincinnati. I really hate the way my voice sounds, but since you like voicemails so much, I'm biting the bullet to send you guys some love. I have been listening for a while now. I will purposely skip a few weeks so I can happily binge some episodes if I'm having a bad day. I very much love and appreciate the work you two do. The research and details are amazing. There's no gimmicks, just facts with some cool, down-to-earth cats. Also, I just saw your pic on your website, and you guys are even more adorable than I imagined. Thanks a lot, and I'll see you on the quiet side.
Thanks, Phoebe. That was super nice.
Yeah, we'll come have a drink with you anytime.
Absolutely. That's it for voicemails, and thanks, everybody. If we can keep getting a few every week, that's awesome.
Okay.
There are two of them, so why don't you do the first one, and I'll do the second one, right? Oh. There's just two written ones?
Two more to go.
Okay. You do this one, I'll do the next one.
Okay. So this first one is from Homsty J. It's a case suggestion. So, hi, Jill and Dick. Her condition is, I will subscribe to your program if you guys do the Holly Bobo case. I am really interested to see your opinion. As a thinking person, I find it a little disturbing how the police convicted someone on no evidence. I feel like in these small towns, the police just feel like they convict someone even if it's not the right someone. And I realize that in some cases, they also seem to let some people go free when there seems like there is overwhelming evidence against them if there is no public outroar. So in the Holly Bobo case, there's a huge uproar. So they just seem to be like, let's just round up a group of lowlifes and then turn them against each other so we can convict at least one of them. Seems like the same process that occurred with the West Memphis group because there is an uproar about the murdered little boys. So what do you guys think? Do you think they arrested the right band of lowlifes? Or could it be the original suspect that is in jail for kidnapping and sexual assault or even someone else entirely?
I think I've listened to a couple of podcasts on this and I've read about it a little bit, but not enough to give my opinion at this point. I do think it's a case we probably will get to. There are just so many cases out there, but it definitely is interesting. I mean, it's a fascinating case. So I think it's probably worth putting on our list at least to do in the near future.
This is a almost 21-year-old.
Yeah, she was a nursing student.
She disappeared from her family home in Tennessee shortly after 8 o'clock. She was seen with a man wearing camouflage gear. And then in 2014, remains were found in northern Tennessee, and her death was ruled a homicide due to a gunshot wound to the back of the head. Six men have been arrested for varying degrees of involvement in the crime. However, only three of the six have been prosecuted. Now, most of the arrests were made on the basis of a confession by a man with an intellectual disability named John Dylan Adams. So the case has been met with several setbacks, such as the death of a suspect, multiple changes to the prosecutorial team, and disputes with the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. Again, three of the six people involved have been sentenced. The latest one was September of 2017. When a jury found one person guilty on all charges, including first-degree murder, he was sentenced to life in prison. He continues to maintain his innocence. And in January of this year, his brother, Dylan, accepted an Alford plea, and he was sentenced to 35 years in prison. Well, yeah. That's some interesting stuff there.
There's definitely a lot that would be worth talking about with that case. You're right.
Okay.
So maybe we'll put it in the not-too-distant future.
Write it down.
Okay. So our last email is from Lauren, and it's a comment on the Rafe Burns case, our episode, Unfortunate Sons. And Lauren says, this is unbelievable. They're both innocent, and the police's tunnel vision, along with the ridiculous so-called confessions, led to their incarceration. This case needs to be reopened, and the original tip by the FBI informant needs to be followed up on. My heart breaks for those boys and their families. They were young and dumb and duped into confessing by Canadian law enforcement. That's the entire case. I work in the judicial system, and this is appalling. So, Dick, this is one of our rare listeners who agrees with us that this was an unjust conviction of these two young men.
You know, when we did this, I thought it was pretty obvious that they didn't do it and somehow had been convicted. But the overwhelming sentiment from our listeners has been that they did it. And
I know,
I'm just thinking, wow, did I screw up somewhere?
Well, I guess it's just a matter of opinion, but the way I looked at it, they had alibis and really not much of a motive.
Right. And there was other viable suspects.
Yes,
that,
and this whole...
That never got investigated.
And the whole mounted police confession, to me, is ridiculous. So I agree with you, Lauren, but most of our listeners haven't, at least not the ones we've heard from.
Nope.
No. Well, that does it for feedback.
Okay.
And we will see you at the quiet end next time.
Come join us.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.